Hello.
Hi guys, how are you?
Hi.
This is really interesting moment when the kind of video goes on for a second as everybody starts to scrutinize who are they actually looking at and where the fuck are they? What are those pictures? What's that door? The window into each other's lives. Who are these people who've now come into my life? Anyway, what should we do?
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is an actor you'll recognise from his roles in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, The Duchess, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, The Last King of Scotland, Jane Eyre and Rev, to name just a few. He's also a Cambridge, Goliath and Lecoq-trained writer and theatre director and the co-founder and artistic director of the monumentally consequential theatre company, Complicity. His many awards include the Berlin Konrad Wolf Prize for Europe's outstanding multidisciplinary artists and the prestigious Yomiuri Prize in Japan, for which he is the first foreign recipient. His latest show is a co-creation with the Olivier Award-winning choreographer and performer Crystal Pite, and thereby a collaboration between Complicité and Nederlands Dance Theatre. It's called Figures in Extinction. Three half-hour dance theatre pieces constructed over 4 years, which explore, respectively, the species and environments we have lost, our disconnection from one another in a separated world, and our relationship with the dead. It is an extraordinary show and an incredible achievement in theatre, and is being recognised as such, consistently receiving five-star reviews across the board from the likes of The Guardian and The Scotsman, as well as winning this year's Sky Arts Award for Dance. Our conversation ranges from what it's like to direct Al Pacino in a play, and the surprisingly improvisational nature of making a Mission Impossible film, to humanity's relationship with mortality, and how to convey that through physical theatre. I've long been hugely inspired by Simon, so this was a massive honour, and my deep thanks to Sadler's Wells for organising it. So please, welcome my guest for this episode. The Titan, that is, Simon McBurney. Simon, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Very happy to do so, Dom.
First of all, congratulations to you and Crystal Pite on Figures in Extinction. It is an extraordinary work of art that is currently continuously being recognised as such. In preparation of this interview, I was struck by a story that you shared of when you were a teenager or maybe younger, you found a dead kestrel and you were so fascinated by it, you took it to a taxidermist to stuff and keep and study. And I was wondering what so fascinated you about the bird, and when you were constructing that piece, did that bird enter into your mind?
Wow, well, that's a lot of research that you've done. I don't remember that specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But since I was a child, the animal world, it's occupied a very big place in my imagination. Mm-hmm. I never had a pet growing up. I had a tortoise, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I then, at a certain point, for a reason, for a story which I'm not going to tell now, I ended up with two ferrets. But it was not something that was encouraged in our house. But the kestrel, I was very touched by when I found it dead, and it was dead of pesticides. And I also discovered a man who was a taxidermist or taxidermist who lived on the outskirts of Norwich. And my mother drove me all the way there. And the man, I don't know, have you ever seen Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
And the, you know, it's extremely dodgy film now. It's really kind of like the take on kind of transvesticism is really not very not very enlightened, let's put it that way. But the mm-hmm. place that he lives in is exactly the place of this man that I was fascinated by, this man's the taxidermist who lived on the edge of Norwich. There were fridges in every room. There were animal guts which lay beside his bed. And I was absolutely fascinated by him. And he did a beautiful job for really not very much money. But his life was taking animals and skinning them and then presenting them. And I was very touched by it. I tell you, one of the reasons that I was touched by it was because I never had the opportunity, a film which drove deep, deep, deep into my imagination as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old was a film by Ken Loach called Kes.
Sure.
And so finding a dead kestrel sort of sparked a lot of different things within me. And so I think that, that's really fascinating that you, I don't know where you got that information from. Anyway, that's a lot of research. And I had it beside my bed, and I think that people, because I had a stuffed kestrel, would give me other stuffed birds that they bought in antique shops. In fact, there's an amazing shop in London, in Islington, called Get Stuffed, which is just antique stuffed animals. You know, it's not kind of getting new ones and stuffing, but they're antiques. And they are quite remarkable. And I had some very, very beautiful ones until I found that it occurred to me that it was a little macabre.
Sure.
And eventually they started to sort of, you know, I can't remember where they went eventually. But it was actually not about the death of these animals. It was about the fact that I felt extremely close to the life of wild animals, which is the central image in Kes, is you know, the wild bird. And then the gulf, if you like, the separation that Berger talks about in this wonderful book called Why Look at Animals. It's an essay. I don't know if you've read it. If you haven't, do read it. It's called Why Look at Animals. And it's really marvelous about the abyss that exists between us and a live animal.
Well, I'd like to return to Figures in Extinction later on, but I first got to know you through your acting work, initially with your role of the Archdeacon in Rev with Tom Hollander, of course. Do you approach finding a character as an actor in the same way that you do devising theatre? Do you have a set process in finding a character?
No. I have no set process. I think on the whole, most actors are extremely intuitive and are quite secret about how they prepare for a role. Some like to propose a particular form. Some people are exhaustive. You know, it's very, very fascinating watching the way that somebody like Robert De Niro prepares, because there are literally, you know, hours and hours and hours of sort of writing and so on and research. And it's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful thought. Because in the end, what you get is Robert De Niro.
Completely.
But it's clearly a wonderful aspect of his own mind, his curiosity and his passion, which marvelously he now takes into the political arena. For me, it's, you know, the process of making something that I make on the stage or that I make myself or that I write is so very, very different to how I might approach a character. I try to throw away a lot of stuff when I'm making a character. I try not to think too much. I don't make exhaustive preparation, unless, for example, recently I had to do a Russian man in a film that will come out, I think, next year. And for that, I did a lot of preparation in terms of the voice, a huge amount. Working every day, and that was very, very helpful and very really, really, really important for me. It's a very instinctive process. I might have chosen only to work on film in another life. I very, very much enjoy it. But I'm extremely lucky because I have several different lives. And so sure. I shouldn't complain at all. I'm unbelievably blessed in terms of the different things that I've been able to work on and to participate in.
Sure.
But if I'm approaching a character, I mean, a lot of what you're doing, when you're making a film, the director or the writer or whoever will have a very specific image in their minds. Mm. And one of your jobs is to shake them out of that image and propose another one. And if they're a really good director, they will be able to see that. Mm. And they will suddenly be able to see a different thing than the thing that they had thought of. So I think some of the mistakes I've ever made as a director is not be able to see the possibilities with a particular actor in front of me, rather than sort of looking for the thing that I have in my mind. So, I mean, it was, yeah. I don't know if that kind of answers your question. I think I wandered off there.
It does. It does. Apologies. No, not at all. But speaking on that last point about directors approaching with a particular image in mind, as a fan of Rev and also Mission Impossible, to see you and Tom Hollander paired up again in a sort of...
Oh, my God, yes.
Not that wildly different a dynamic as Attlee and Prime Minister and Rev and Deacon. Do you know if that was intentional? Did they see the show?
No, it wasn't. Not at all. Not at all. Wow, okay. In fact, Tom was kind of furious that he didn't have my role because Attlee was a more interesting role than the Prime Minister. I think he was somewhat pissed off. But I mean, he's an out and out actor. Which, as I say, partly, you know, if I had another life, I might just do that. But I'm my brother calls me constitutionally disobedient. And so that I'm also kind of like I'm also constitutionally curious, and everything new interests me. And I'm constantly finding that I want to find new ideas, you know, new thoughts. And probably whatever time is left to me, probably also make more films myself. I mean, I've made lots of small films and different elements. But film acting is a really, really curious thing because you've got to stick at it, yeah. But you also have to have a great deal of fortune. So you've got to be in the right place at the right time. You've got to be available. You've got to be, people have got to want you. You can be a remarkable actor and yet not really, as it were, hit it with the sequence of things. It's very, very fascinating because it also touches on a kind of social wave where there is a particular person that people want to see, and then, you know, off you go. And you might not be the most interesting actor in the world, but it's the one that people want to see. But I do love it. I love performing on film, and I love the process of telling stories on film. And it's very, very fascinating.
Well, on that, I imagine making a Mission Impossible film is pretty far removed from making a Complicité production. How would you characterize Christopher McQuarrie's style of directing?
Improvisational.
Really? Okay.
So on the Mission Impossible that I did, it still wasn't written when I was performing.
Okay.
So they were trying to work out what they were going to write next. Now, this is very, very rare on a film of that scale. I would say almost unprecedented. But it speaks to the extraordinary star power of Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
That he can get a film made without there being a script.
So how far in advance to your scenes were you being handed pages of fresh dialogue?
Well,
was it a morning off?
Generally, you get a whole script before you accept the role.
Or sure.
But I didn't. That isn't the case on Mission Impossible. you go along for the ride and you're going to get the scenes that you'll get. And occasionally Christopher McQuarrie would say, well, I think there'll be another scene. And I did do my absolute best to try to persuade him to keep the character of Atlee, because he doesn't really die. And, you know, as being a kind of really disgusting, nefarious character, which I really enjoyed playing. But he didn't buy it in the end. So I did not become a series regular, which would have been a lot of fun. Yeah.
Sure. You mentioned a little while back Robert De Niro. You famously, of course, directed Al Pacino. What was that experience like?
Wonderful. It was all my childhood heroes in one room.
Wow.
So, you know, the moment I was attached to direct this with Al at the Actors, National Actors Theatre, with Tony Randall. Tony Randall, who himself was, of course, a very famous actor at that point. It was very curious because I was suddenly in the position where everybody wanted to be in it because Al was in it. They didn't care. So I was able to turn down big, big Hollywood stars would ring me and plead to be in the piece with Al because everybody adored Al, and there was something about his charisma which meant that you know people simply wanted to work with him, so therefore I could pick anybody I want. So I kind of, you know, airily, when the casting director came with me and said, well, who do you think could play this, I thought it would be ridiculous to say, well, I think I'll have, you know, Jiri should be John Goodman, and, you know, Jivola should be Steve Buscemi. I thought, this is impossible. And then suddenly there they were. You know, and then people like Billy Crudup taking a very minor role, and Paul Giamatti also taking a tiny role. Chaz Parmentieri, who was absolutely terrifying, and who in rehearsal, when anybody got out of hand, he said, he stood right behind me and said, you don't speak like that to the director. Simon's my director, and we do what he says. I mean, he had my back literally like a kind of wise guy. And wow. And he's the real thing. He grew up in that environment. His scar all the way down his side of his face. And he grew up with wise guys, with the Italian mafia. That was his childhood. And people were kind of terrified of him. So it was, it was amazing. And half the cast of The Sopranos, Dominic Chianese and Johnny Ventimiglia, and this soul singer called Novella Nelson, and so it goes on, you know. Oh, my God. Lothair Bluto took a silent role in it.
Wow.
It was very, very wonderful. Oh, yes. And Sterling K. Brown, he took a tiny, he auditioned with me for everybody, and he took a minute role in it. Now he's a massive star.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary. It was a most extraordinary cast. Nobody got paid anything. Everybody shared a dressing room.
Mm.
It was hilarious and marvelous. And I was completely out of control. I had no idea what was going on. In the middle of it, my best friend died, a woman called Katrin Cartledge, who was an incredible actress with Mike Leigh. She did Naked, and she was also in Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves, and an amazing, wonderful friend and brilliant actress. She died at 42, very suddenly.
I'm sorry.
It was awful, and nobody knew what she died of for a year. They couldn't work out why she died, and they discovered she had a very, very, very rare condition, which was very difficult to diagnose. And so it was like a car crash without the car or anything. And then, you know, they said to her, who do you, you know, I said, well, couldn't we get Tom Waits to do the music? And then suddenly Tom Waits was on the line, you know. The whole thing was really a very extraordinary experience. Kind of surreal to think of it now. Charles Durning, who was the great Charles Durning, wonderful man, incredible man. They all sat in the corner and they told stories. Tony Randall, Al Pacino, Charles Durning, Dominic Chianese, they all had these kind of old time stories, which were hilarious, hilarious. And I got them all doing yoga. I mean, it's unbelievable. I turned John Goodman onto yoga. At that point, he had a kind of alcohol problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that it helped him enormously and he could sweat it out. And I mean, there's so many stories there, Dom. Some of them I can't, you know, I would be in sort of almost legal difficulty if I spilled some of the beans, but there I should really write them down. It was an extraordinary experience. Sure. And of course, it was a little bit after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And because part of the idea I had was I set it in the 1930s prior to the Second World War, which is when it's set, you know, the resistible rise of Arturo Uy in the time of Brecht. But what I did is I got the costumes metamorphosed throughout the entire... sorry, that's my son. Hang on a second. I'm just going to send him a quick message.
Sure thing.
Hang on, I'm just here. Yeah, there we are. That's done.
Well, it must be. Is it daunting to stand as the authority figure in, as you say, a room of childhood and probably adult heroes, and be that?
Well, at a certain moment, you're all just actors.
Sure. Yeah.
And most of being in a room of actors is just like being in a room of children, really.
Yeah.
Because they start to amuse each other. And all storytellers, so they all, the moments of break, they're all telling stories, and they all have their own ship, you know, and it's wonderful. And everybody, everybody is. I mean, it was wild, absolutely wild, because they were all, you know, they're all, you know, first class. I mean, it was extraordinary to be able to pick and choose whoever I wanted. It was quite amazing.
Well, absolutely. I hope you do turn it into a book and put down these stories, or at the very least tell me them off air, because I really want to hear a lot of them, and I understand I don't want to get lawyers involved. Speaking of being sort of potentially being daunted, I'm a director myself. I know of a lot of young theatre makers or sort of early career theatre makers. There's this sense of potentially feeling overwhelmed with a project, of being sort of halfway through and you don't know if you're going to have a show at the end, and you don't know if that show's going to be good. And I was going to ask you how you develop the confidence of knowing at that sort of in the middle of the fog that it's going to be okay. And then I learned about Disappearing Number and opening night in Plymouth, and how that, how was that experience? You're shaking your head for the listeners. How was that experience sort of, has that boldened you or giving you sort of more of a confidence?
No, I mean, it's terrifying. I've done a lot of pieces where I really don't know what I'm doing. And that was certainly in the first 5 years. I mean, the dominant idea for me in those first 5 years was I wanted people to laugh. Mm. And I also wanted a kind of vehicle which would allow me to, you know, fuck off anywhere and have a piece of theatre to play and be in another place every night and find out about the world, which was, I had the most extraordinary experience. We were sent by the British Council, sent us all the way around South America in the 1980s. I had a lot of friends who were Chilean refugees when we were working a lot in Oxford out of a youth theatre called the Pegasus Youth Theatre. And there were several Chilean refugees who became my friend in East Oxford. And when the British Council proposed that we go to Chile because Pinochet was still in power, I said absolutely under no circumstances was I going to go to a fucking despotic, tyrannical country like that. until I talked to my Chilean refugees, said, no, you must go. And then they put me in touch with people who were in resistance, who put us in the back of cars, hid us under blankets, and took us out to Poblacion and shanty towns where we performed in the street for people who we shouldn't have been allowed to perform to. And we had the most extraordinary experiences. And so we ended up performing in very, very, very amazing places. But when you're starting out, you've just got to do everything and anything. The difficulty of the narrative, the success that we have in at the end of the first quarter of the 21st century, is that all of these narratives are given to you by other people rather than you making your own narrative. So the question of what makes you successful is to do with your profile, to do with your social media, to do with how everybody else sees you, as opposed to the actual lived experience. So the fictional experience has become very, very powerful within the cycle of the way that our minds work. So not only do we have to do something, but we have to be seen to be doing something. We have to write it. We have to show it. We have to be out there, you know. And in terms of your success, it can be measured in terms of the numbers of your followers. But then that becomes problematic, because there are people with millions of followers who are completely vacuous, who have nothing to say whatsoever. And so deep down, we know that that is completely meaningless. But, you know, in terms of people starting out, if you want to do something, somehow you've just simply got to do it. Now, it's much more difficult because it costs a lot more. The cost of everything is difficult. And here I'm not talking about the financial cost, but it is extremely difficult. But I started sort of outside. We never attached ourselves to a status quo ever. We just gathered ourselves together as a bunch of gypsies and said, we want to make something. We'll try and scrape together whatever pennies we have and we will make it. The very first show I did, at that time there were what were called art centers, which virtually don't exist anymore. But we were simply rang up art centers and did a kind of, and we pretended on the phone, said, I'm so sorry, I've got New York on the other line. Ridiculous things. We played characters in order to persuade them to take us. And sometimes they could hardly pay us. They might give us a split here and there. But we created ourselves a tour, and then we made a show, and then we toured it, and then we made another one, and we made another one, and so on. And if we didn't have anywhere to play, we played on the streets. So we simply played because we wanted to play. We didn't wait for anybody to ask us or to come knocking. We just simply made things because we felt compelled to do so. And that's very important. It's much, much harder now because the infrastructure was much looser then. The constraints were less tight. I'm not saying that we should loosen every rule, but in the 1980s there was still considerable number of people of great influence who had been powerful operators in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and in terms of the counter-revolution. So if they saw you were trying to do something which was outside the edges of what normal society worked in terms of, you know, not going to the normal theatres or not going. I mean, because we wanted to perform, we perform anywhere. We perform on the streets, we perform in prisons, we performed in schools, we performed anywhere. We didn't really care, provided we got to do it. And that, I remember John Berger saying, hope is a form of energy.
Wow, yeah.
Hope is a form of energy, and it is sometimes at its most powerful when things are most dark. So the people that I'm in touch with, very closely in touch with in Gaza, have this energy extraordinarily, and I don't know how they do, but they do have an energy of hope. Yeah. And they have things to, they have extraordinary things to communicate from that darkness. And I read out the words of one of the people that I'm in touch with in Gaza on the night that we got our Sky Arts Award in London.
Yeah.
So we are in a very dark time, and I feel, as part of the boomer generation, I feel, of course, necessarily responsible, because we have been busy creating the world. Many of us have been involved in resistance of different sorts, but the world is where it is, with a large number of despots in power, and is everything upside down, so that we have a Labour government that has nothing to do with Labour, has nothing to do with the socialist ideas on which it was founded. You know, there's this vast dishonesty from Starmer, Yvette Cooper. All these people are deeply, deeply, deeply dishonest. And that's very, very worrying, because we have to find out where, you know, how do we resist? How do we manage to participate in creating a different world?
You mentioned about being observed and observation, and I just wanted to pull focus to a line from the first part of Figures in Extinction, which is, with our zoos, our categories and our farming, animals are always observed. The fact they observe us has lost all significance. Was it always your idea to make a trilogy of the show?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
At what point did that sort of emerge from Ian McGilchrist's lecture? Did you go, this needs to be a dance piece and it needs to be three?
It emerged from a set of conversations about where the world is and about how we behave. So they were conversations about the body, conversations about the geopolitical landscape, conversations about conflict, conversations about the future, conversations about the fact of having children and what kind of world we are creating, conversations about choices and why those occur. And as a result, we ended up with this idea. I think I was probably pushing it a little bit more than Crystal. I say that, but that could be my kind of slightly faulty memory. I've had a lifelong friendship, at least in terms of my life, but the last 25 years of his life, with the writer, art critic, and, I would say philosopher and a lot more, called John Berger, who wrote the great book Ways of Seeing and the television program, and who is an extraordinary social, political, literary, philosophical figure. But also somebody who just lived in the high mountains in France, because he was somebody who was kind of permanently in exile. And I got to know him at the beginning of the 1990s when he came to see something I did at the National, and we were very, very, very close friends for 25 years. And I pushed some of that writing towards Crystal. And I think that I was extremely passionate, because we have children, about the nature of the way that we perceive the, let's call it the living world rather than nature, of which we are a part, and asking questions as to how is it possible to talk about the current situation in a way that can touch people without appearing to be pushing an agenda, yet at the same time an agenda is incredibly important, because we're in an extremely urgent situation as regards your generation and my children's generation, and we've kind of fucked it up. And so how do we take responsibility for that? Well, at the very least, we talk about it and try to make something with it. So then the first piece, which is now called The List, which was originally simply called Figures in Extinction, because the figures are like kind of, figure is like a kind of ghost which is already gone, or it's an outline, or it's a shape. It could be both people, and it could also be plants. It can also be animals. So there is a kind of, it seemed to us, a good title. It also suggests numbers, as you know, and that can be numbers of years, that could be numbers of people, that could be figures can also be almost like spirits. So one of the things that I was passionate about from the beginning was this idea of separation and dissociation. What is it about how we live now? What is it in the way that we think which separates us one from another, or separates us from one thing and another, which might separate us from the living world as what we call human beings, and sometimes people call nature? What separates us in terms of our language, in terms of everything which we can see around us, which produces this sense of division, and crucially, what separates the living from the dead, which is a very new phenomenon. In fact, it's very odd to say that to people. Well, you know, we're separated from the dead. People will look at you askance. You know, there's a famous thing about Donald Trump standing in front of Arlington Cemetery and saying they're all losers. So, you know, there's an idea that, you know, the dead are in some sense the eliminated. They don't exist. And so that is a these are fundamental changes in the way that we think. And one of the texts which has always interested me very, very much, books, is by this book by Ian McGilchrist called The Master and His Emissary, in which he details how the human mind has, the brain has developed, let's call it the Western brain particularly, although it is all over the world, but it is the notion of the sort of almost post-enlightenment brain, and therefore the industrial brain, and therefore the pre-industrial, post-industrial, a digital brain, which is what we are in possession of now, why we have arrived at this point where the part of our brain which is so clever at separating out the world as an object has come to dominate the rest of the brain, which integrates the whole and sees us as part of an entire organism, if you like. The world is a complete organism. The universe is a complete organism. We know this scientifically because we live in a post-Einsteinian universe. We understand the idea of chaos theory and the interrelationship of absolutely everything that occurs. And yet we have gone down this rabbit hole whereby we think that things are separate. And this, of course, is an absolutely fertile breeding ground for tyranny and despotism, because it allows you to separate. You know, we can see that in the 19th century. There are black people, there are white people, there are brown people, there are white people, and so on. And all the way down, the animals are there for us. You know, the resources of the earth are to be exploited, and so on. Which is a new thing. I'm talking about new in the terms of the last 1,000 years. This was not always the case. We were not human beings always the center of our world. If you look at the cave paintings in the Chauvet cave, for example, which are 35,000 years, there are human hands, and there is almost certainly the female sex portrayed, but that's only once. And the hands are on one particular wall. But the rest are animals. Everything else are animals. So the representation they would have, there's no, that is what was important for them, was the world and their connection to animals. So they were on the periphery of an animal world rather than the animals being on the periphery of the human world. So at a certain point, we become centered within this world, rather, and at that point, we lose our attachment to it. I guess that's all a bit of kind of waffle, really. But it, you know, it turns out that I knew early on that I wanted to be able to, as a result of something that John Berger wrote, which is called 12 Theses on the Economy of the Dead, I knew that partly because of my own experience, because of the different people who have vanished from my life, from the living world, and the fact of John's own death in 2017, I knew that I wanted to use this text, which was called 12 Theses on the Economy of the Dead, in some form, or it was inspirational for me. It was one of the first things after I met him, it was one of the first things he sent me. And so I knew that was one of the pieces I wanted that. And then we worked out, Crystal and I, that the first piece should be about the living world. And she became very interested in the idea of a list of extinctions. Mm. So the idea of the three was that she would make the first one and I would, as it were, be her co-pilot. Mm. So the kind of, and it's quite interesting everywhere in it, in France particularly, and here is another sign of division, they go choreographie, Crystal Pite, mise en scène, Simon McBurney. And that's actually not true. Crystal does lots of mise en scène. I also do lots of choreography. So the whole thing is a kind of mess and a mixture. And indeed, the dancers themselves are also creators in it. And again, it's a whole notion of the way that we think, the, you know, the Western European development of the mind, in which we categorize and shape and divide and so on, which means that we see, you know, see something like culture as, you know, whatever it was Steven Pinker said, it's, you know, cheesecake for the mind, you know, as the third dish, whereas in fact it's the only course, because culture is the other words that come out of my mouth. It's the sweater that you're wearing. It's the color you have on you. It's everything, including the cut of your hair and your beard and so on. It is who we are. There isn't anything else. There is only our culture. That is what enables us to communicate. And so this, the list in the very first bit became a kind of sign of the way that we cut everything up. And it is a list of extinctions, but it's also, you know, it's got a lot of wit about it. Crystal was determined that one of the creatures going extinct would be the climate denier. So that's, you know, the appearance of that. And it's not really very clear whether the things that we're representing really are animals, or whether they're kind of hybrids. In fact, the only animal there is a skeleton, a very wonderful skeleton of a cheetah, of an Asiatic cheetah. Other than that, the animals don't really exist. They are just simply human beings who are expressing something. And as it were, the shape between human beings and the animals is really not entirely clear. So, I mean, in the first one, for example, I worked with the composer and who I don't know if you know, composer and musician Cosmo Sheldrake. I don't know if you've heard of him, but I worked I worked in his studio, and we fucked about with the idea of lists of animals and so on. And I sent that's the kind of gear that I sent to Crystal. I gave her articles, pictures, music, stuff of my daughter talking about the birds that disappeared when we sat at the window recording her. I just sent her a lot of material, and then she started to get excited by some of the things and not so excited about other things. She made her own choice. And then I sat in on rehearsals and suggested, you know, had different kinds of ideas. And then in the second piece, it was the reverse. So I already had little bits of choreography and ideas of what people might do. And I had an idea, and one of the marvelous things in the second piece was she pushed me towards one particular idea. So it was a kind of push me, pull you thing. When she was leading, I would push her in a certain direction, and then she would pick up on it. So I had an idea for the beginning, and then she went, oh, that's marvelous, and it took that and ran with it. I recorded things, I discovered things, I gave her all sorts of ideas. And the second one, she pushed me in a funny sort of way, when you're not actually the only person leading it, it's incredibly useful to have somebody pushing you.
Yeah.
Saying, well, what about this? What about that? Let me try this. Let me do that. So then I was able to push the idea of the cheetah, you know, and the manipulation of the cheetah and how it works and the kind of puppeteering of that and various other things that, you know, were, as it were, things that I knew should be there, including kind of the build-up, the climax, and in the end where things simply get more and more and more and more and more. But similarly, she became obsessed with this cartoon version of the Master and His Emissary.
Yeah.
And although I had talked about this book, I hadn't actually thought, well, let's use the cartoon. And she said, well, why not? Why not use that as a kind of text? Because it's helpful for us to be able to fasten onto it. And thereafter, I started to, that enabled me. So in the third one, which was almost there from the beginning. So the second one is sort of the separation in our own minds between the right and the left hemisphere. So there's something about the way that we go about the world whereby, for example, you know, we are unable to see, you know, we have been encouraged to see certain people as less than human, you know, which has resulted in the slave trade, which has resulted in currently at the moment the genocide that's going on in Palestine, you know, because, you know, as far as the Israelis are concerned, Palestinians are less than human. They're just animals. And as far as Donald Trump is the same. And this has been, it's not a new phenomenon. This has been so throughout history. But it is a relatively new idea. It's not to say that people haven't slaughtered each other in vast numbers. But in general, people have understood that they are slaughtering another human being. And people have both accepted, and, you know, violence has always been, you know, a part of the human psyche. But it is a new thing in terms of the way that we separate ourselves out. And the separation that happens sort of begins to happen, as McGilchrist points out, you know, around about 300-400 years ago. And then becomes deepened with the Industrial Revolution. So then that became the second piece. But right from the beginning, I felt passionately, I've always been one of the very first things that John Berger sent me when I started to get to know him was a piece called The 12 Theses on the Economy of the Dead. And so I've always had that very close in my heart in terms of what is our relationship with the dead and why have we become separated?
I wanted to change slight tack to growing up. You talked about before, you didn't have a TV. It was a lot of reading. It was your dad's hi-fi, as I think you referred to it as. And you once told the story of how you'd have to make up, in order to not lose face in front of peers, make up that you'd seen last night's Doctor Who. And you go, oh, yes, I saw that when the Daleks came out.
Well, I mean, I can actually almost see blow for blow with John Pertwee, the very first Doctor Who episode that I saw, which traumatized me.
Okay.
It was so powerful to me what happened. I found the music of Doctor Who absolutely terrifying, completely terrifying. Dan, 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 dan. You know, it was absolutely Yeah, I mean, the power of that program when you haven't seen it, but you understand the context of it, is extraordinary. And yes, I would have to, in order to join in conversations, of course, I would have to make up that I had seen various things, and therefore I had to be a very, very quick storyteller and pick up on what other people had seen. But I also remember standing in the rain, looking through people's front windows at a distance, trying to watch the television because we had no television at home. Yeah. I might kind of walk downstairs and film my cup of tea, but carry on. I'll just walk and talk.
Did, when you got your first acting work on TV, did that have extra significance then as a result of someone who'd sort of mythologized television to then get to be on it?
I guess so. I mean, I didn't really think of it like that.
Okay, I'll do three quick questions to round off. The first one is, when you're acting, what impresses you about a director? What can a director do that makes you feel like, oh, I'm in safe hands here?
Encouragement. Mm-hmm. Being able to describe the picture of what they're looking for, and a fundamental understanding that. That you are able to give them something else that they want, rather than sometimes with a director there can be a lack of imagination, saying, "Well, what I see is what I get." But the whole point about an actor is that you act, and you become something else. So if they're clear about what they want, you can then just simply lean towards whatever that is. And I think it's really developing this intimate relationship. I mean, sometimes many, many, many directors are completely inarticulate. I mean, it's also a responsibility of an actor to try and understand, for want of putting it any other way, where a director is coming from. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to give you an example of that. Working with, I'll go in another room. Can you find me a piece of chocolate, please? Yeah, it's my son.
Sure.
You know, recently last year, in fact, I had a wonderful experience working on this film, Nosferatu, with Robert Eggers.
Yeah.
Now, he's very, very interesting because he encourages you to keep on going. But the way that he communicates it is curious because it's not obvious. But in all his films, he gets really very extreme performances out of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not performances which are, they're not just simply grotesques. They have a really solid core in the center of them. I mean, in the Lighthouse. Yeah, humanity. And they're very, very... You know, but they are kind of bizarre. There is an element of Robert Eggers which is a distant cousin of David Lynch, but in a slightly, you know, Robert is much more interested in the Gothic, I think, than Lynch was. Lynch was in a kind of modern Gothic, or a different, slightly different kind of thing. But they're both interested in the darker regions of the soul. Without a doubt. And it's kind of unsurprising that, you know, Willem Dafoe acted for David Lynch and he acts, you know, for Robert, because, you know, he's absolutely Robert's kind of actor.
Completely. Back in tone to the room of taxidermy we talked about before, of that sort of slightly unsettling nature.
Yeah, exactly. The Lighthouse is very, very odd film.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's very peculiar, but it's wonderful and gripping and free. And it was a lot of fun to work for him.
I'm sure. My penultimate question is, we're speaking, of course, in advance of Figures and Extinction coming to Sadler's Wells on the 5th of November. What do you think, in your view, makes Sadler's Wells as a theatre special? What do you think... makes it stand apart?
Oh, Well, it's been completely remade as a theatre. That's a wonderful thing. That's absolutely wonderful because it really enables you to do, to go very far. It's also unlike, I mean, partly because of its programming, it's very, very much unlike the rest of other theatres in London. It's now opened a second theatre, but I think that they, I mean, you know, I have my own opinions, but I think they should be a little bit more if they didn't think that one type of theatre had to go in Rosebery Avenue and the other one in the East End, the other kind of stuff in the East End. I think that should be a great deal more interconnected, and I think it probably will be in the future. It takes time for people to, in everything, as I get older, I just realize how long it takes for people to get out of certain railway tracks in terms of what they do. And that's certainly true in terms of the way that we think about the world and what is happening in the world, is that we're finding it very, very difficult to shift our narratives. And everything, as we know, is about narrative. Everything is about story. Otherwise there would be, a Reform Party, because nobody would, you know, the only reason there is they have this entirely spurious narrative, of course, which people continue to spew out. So everything is story. Everything is story. Every single thing is story. And that's part of what is being a human being, is that we're compulsive storytellers. And we have a little bit of a problem because we also believe there's something called the truth as something separate. There isn't a gap between truth and story. The difficulty for us right now is that we have never been surrounded by so much fiction, either in history or prehistory. And our individual stories, which are made up of our individual experiences, have been cushioned by a set of almost veils, and in some case walls, and in some case roads, between what is actually happening and what is happening. So that people no longer know what is happening at all. And so at that point, you have to be a very convincing storyteller to be able to find out and be able to propose those things which change the way that people see the world. And that is our responsibility as artists. We have to be able to cut through and show a different story. And it's an incredibly important position in the world. And of course, the reason why people don't want us to do that is because they understand the potential power of it. You know, money doesn't really exist. It's an idea. It's just simply an idea. And what is thought to be real in people's minds is also an idea. The only thing that exists between you and I is our words, what we see, what we feel. And that is culture and that is art. It's not a, whatever Steven Pinker said, you know, mental cheesecake. Art is essentially mental cheesecake. It isn't. It's the only thing. There isn't anything else except our communication. And that is culture. And so therefore, necessarily, as we drift into totalitarianism, or we surge into it, of course, necessarily, artists are always going to be deeply in the firing line.
Yeah, it's similar to the McLuhan phrase of the medium is the message, and the concept of it being portrayed, or conveyed, rather. You've in essence preempted my final question, which I ask every guest who's been on the show, which is, why do we need stories?
Well, we are. That's a little bit like saying, why are we human beings? Human beings have evolved as storytelling creatures. That is, we are only narrative. That is all we are. That is who we are. And if we understand that everything is simply a fabricated narrative, then at that point we can begin to change it and change things. Because to change things, we need to alter the story. If we, what?
Do you know where a pump is?
A pump?
Yeah.
Not right now, but I can in probably 5 minutes come and help you.
Okay.
Yeah, you can have that bit. You can have it all, in fact.
Oh, yeah.
Just on a call.
And sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm just trying to hang on one moment. Let me just see if I can find something.
Sure.
The pump, presumably.
I think I'll probably be able to find it here. Use this device rather than anything else. I'm just needing to look it up. Hang on a second.
Oh, sure, yeah.
There we go. Here we go. Oh, yes, now I've got it. We are all storytellers. Lying on our backs, we look up at the night sky. This is where stories began, under the aegis of that multitude of stars which at night filch certitudes and sometimes return them as faith. Those who first invented and then named the constellations were storytellers, tracing an imaginary line between a cluster of stars, gave them an image and an identity. The stars threaded on that line were like events threaded on a narrative. Imagining the constellations did not, of course, change the stars, nor did it change the black emptiness that surrounds them. What it changed was the way people read the night sky. And I suppose, you know, if you change the night sky for the disaster of the world, that is what we have to do as storytellers, is we have to change the way that people interpret and see both the light and the darkness in the world. Because that is what it can change, I guess.
What a beautiful note for us to end on, and so sort of in keeping with the spirit of Figures in Extinction. Congratulations again. It is a tremendous show. I had the opportunity to see a recording of it ahead of this interview, and I'll get to see it on opening night on the 5th, and I'm so excited to see it again.
Well, I'll probably see you there.
I look forward to it. Simon, thank you so much
for talking to me today.
Not at all. Okay. Cheers.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.